Okay, so moving on then to practical issues. How can one apply the middle way in practice? And in a way, I don't think any of this would be a lot of help if there wasn't some way of applying middle way in practice in ethical judgments. And I think there is. It's not a cut and dried way. It's not going to provide instant certainty in any moral situation. But nevertheless, the middle way can provide us with ways forward. It can support and guide moral judgment. So I think to understand this, I had to start with the three main types of theory in Western philosophy, because I think those three main types of theory, moral theory, about how we should act, how we should decide how we should act, identify three basic approaches which need to be taken into account. So consequentialism says we should act so as to bring about the best consequences, as in utilitarianism. So that means you think out before you do something. You think, well, what will happen if I do this? What sort would it be, good or bad effects? Will people suffer? Will other people gain pleasure from it? Will I gain pleasure from it, etc.? Now, regardless of what exactly you think the best consequences are, that general approach is consequentialism. Deontological ethics, you've got a principle or a set of principles and you follow those principles. So again, your ethics will be deontological whether those principles are given to you by God or whether they're based on rational consistency like Kantian ethics. So again, that's a general approach. You find a principle and you follow it, and that's your basis of ethical judgment. And then the third approach is virtue ethics. So there you don't think so much about making the right decision in a specific situation. Instead, you think about becoming a better person. So you do that by working on your habits. So you might do it, for example, by going on retreat and getting yourself away from your normal habits so that you have a chance to reflect on those habits and maybe come back into slightly improved ones when you go back. See things like meditation could be very much seen as working on ourselves so that we just as total organic beings get into better habits. So that means when we get to making moral judgments, well, we'll do it better because we'll be in a more balanced state, effectively, a better state. Virtue ethics is an alternative stream of thinking in Western thought, which particularly is indebted to Aristotle and Aristotle's account of what it is to be a virtuous person, to be a good person. And in the classic version, you don't worry about specific judgments at all. You just assume that if you're the right sort of person, then you'll make the right sorts of judgments. Now, the way in which we approach moral dilemmas in practice tends to depend on the priority between these sorts of approaches. So, perhaps there are some moral decisions we make which seem straightforward. There's not all our moral intuitions or moral reflections are pointing us in one direction, so there's no particular dilemma there. But moral dilemmas usually involve a conflict of some kind. So the classic one is between consequentialism and deontological ethics. Maybe there's some sort of deep-rooted principle you feel to be right. Maybe it's been deeply imbued by your society. But that's clashing with what you need to do in the circumstances to bring about some important consequence.
The fat man on the bridge.
The fat man on the bridge, yes. So the example I've got here is cannibalism in extreme circumstances. So cannibalism is imbued as an evil thing to do in our culture. Not in absolutely every culture, but cannibalism, and here obviously you've got to distinguish cannibalism from murder. You know, it's not necessarily attached to murder because the people may be dead already. there's a classic case of I think it was in the 1970s that people stranded in the Andes due to a plane crash, and they survive by eating the bodies of the people who'd died in the plane crash, and live to tell the tale. So there's an obvious justification there, isn't there? It's in terms of consequences. They lived.
Yeah. Not everyone did. Some of them chose not to eat them and died.
Right.
I remember a really touching bit where someone was dying and said to one of the other people that's still alive, "It's okay, you can eat me." It was actually quite moving in the situation. God. Yeah.
You could eat me, Julian.
Oh, thanks, Barry.
Glad we got that cleared up.
You could eat me too.
Oh dear. Such friendship we developed. Yeah.
That goes for all of you.
Oh dear.
Okay, but because you can perhaps also see why a revulsion towards cannibalism has developed in our society. You know, perhaps because it's often linked to murder, and it's also to do perhaps with our feelings about persons and respect for persons and their bodies. So in normal circumstances, you could argue, well, not being a cannibal is you know, got a lot to be said for it. okay, and then another example, just to show how virtue ethics might be involved in moral dilemmas, going on a retreat versus social action. So during this week, we've been on retreat. We've not been doing much for society in that week. You know, we could have been presumably going out and helping people instead of talking about middle way philosophy. So we've been focusing on, I would argue, well, longer term things, which is important to think about at least from time to time. But that's the focus there is on virtue ethics, on becoming, you know, clearer, you know, better people, in effect, partly because we've got more wisdom or clearer thought processes, or whatever that is, or better mental states. And so that may, in the longer term, improve our judgments. But nevertheless, there's a dilemma there.
Mm.
You know, particularly if we're neglecting some important thing that perhaps we should be doing outside the retreat context, that would be a real dilemma. And I could understand it, you know, been difficult for somebody with your very young children, for example, to come on retreat. They've got much sort of stronger dilemma to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So they would to decide to do that. So how do we resolve dilemmas like this in general? So my argument here is that none of the three approaches is always or absolutely appropriate. And the reason why we can't conclude that none of them is always or absolutely appropriate is simply uncertainty. We know that any principle that we might adopt addresses conditions to some extent, perhaps, but not entirely. So there will be uncertainty about this, just as there is about any kind of factual claim. So we're using basically the same ways of judging these moral claims as we would about, you know, scientific claims, for example. You can accept them provisionally, they're applicable in certain circumstances, but you also bear in mind their fallibility. So if we bear in mind that uncertainty and that fallibility, that will place limitations on the way we use these types of theory. So consequentialism, the particular fallibility there, as I mentioned earlier, is neglecting the person who's making the judgments. So particularly utilitarianism tends to assume a sort of absolute standpoint of judgment that almost we're like God, that we can decide what the good consequences of actions are going to be, and on the basis of that, decide what the best thing to do is. So the person making judgments can completely misjudge the outcomes of those of that judgment. The main issue with deontological ethics, well, perhaps two major issues really. One is the authority of its principles, so where have those principles come from? So if you're just appealing to the principle because it's come from God, for example, then well, that's liable to lead to inflexibility of one sort or another.
There's also the idea of responsibility. You know, if you do what you're told, you're arguing you never grow up.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah. So that's taking responsibility for the interpretation of the principle is an important part of that, isn't it? In the way we might modify principles. But perhaps the biggest practical issue is simply the inflexibility of principles. It doesn't allow us to respond to events. So if you do think cannibalism is wrong and you end up in a blank question in the end, it's, well, maybe, you know, even this principle as strong as that should be compromised. But, you know, in order to compromise that principle, you've got to have a jolly good reason. So, you know, there's another way of thinking appearing into play there. It's a consequentialist way in this case. And then virtue ethics, again, sounds good. It's thinking long term. It's not just focusing on a particular judgment at a particular time. But on the other hand, it doesn't really tell you, just by itself, it doesn't tell you how to judge immediate pressing issues. It doesn't tell you how to make decisions at all, in fact. It doesn't give you any guidance. It leaves you with the assumption that if you're the right sort of person, you'll make the right decisions. Mm. So, again, just focusing on virtue ethics doesn't seem to be enough by itself, even though virtue ethics in general, taking that attitude in the long term may help us considerably in making better ethical decisions. You can see it as a kind of, I suppose, in investment model almost, that, you know, we invest in our ethical judgment by becoming better people, and as a result we reap the rewards of better judgment in the future.
Would it be right in saying it's often said that of the three ethical models here, the one that resonates most with Buddhist ethics is the virtue ethics model?
Yeah, I think that will probably be correct, yeah. I mean, there's a whole book about this by Damien Cowan, which is very descriptive, really, but he just looks at Buddhist ethics as it's been practiced and thought about and reaches whatever that conclusion is. Okay, so my argument here is that these three approaches, they offer a palette of different challenges. So you might think of it as being like a painter's palette or a toolbox, alternatively, but you know, you've got different resources available to you, which you can then apply to imbue your judgments with greater objectivity. And you have to select the right tool for the right task, or the right colour for the right bit of the painting. So how will these help in each case? Well, consequentialism makes us face up to the effects of our actions, so there's obviously objectivity there. We're facing up to the conditions which might result from acting in a particular way, so that becomes generally a stronger and more justified way of thinking, where we have pretty good evidence for what's going to happen when we act in a particular way. So, you know, there is such a thing as unnecessary doubt. You know, if I thought about, you know, hitting Julian on the head, you know, it's pretty obvious Julian's going to be hurt by me hitting him on the head. So there's no excuse for me.
So would
to
you?
Yes, <indeed.
laughs>
yeah. So it's no excuse just to be sceptical in that circumstance. Well, I don't really know what he really so that where the evidence is clear, consequentialism is pretty useful.
Could you also say that you can make a relationship with time and consequentialism? The further something is away, then the more vague, maybe the less effective the chances are that it'll be. But if you're near, you get in time, then, I mean, just generalising.
Generally, yeah.
Because the uncertainty increases generally.
Yeah.
But as I said the other day, there are some things which are relatively far ahead, which we can predict pretty well, like the half-life of radioactive substances, say.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, assessment of consequentialism, I suppose it depends on how well we can assess things around us. It also depends on assessing our own judgment. So, probably more justified in using it if I know that I'm a good judge, or relatively good judge, than if I'm aware of the fact that I can make lots of mistakes, particularly in a particular area.
Mm.
Yeah. We're making kind of subtle social judgments about what to do at parties and stuff like that. I'm not a particularly good judge. Yeah. So I'd be happy to, in that particular case, I often take the advice of my wife, who's really good at this. Okay. Go on to deontology then. So the strength of deontology, the objectivity of deontology, is it makes us face up to inconsistency. So this is the thing that the strength of Kantian thinking, that where we make an exception of ourselves, it's okay for me to pollute the environment or drop litter, for example, or something like this. But I wouldn't want everyone else doing it, but it's okay if I do it. Mm. So it's probably easier to relate that to our experience, that we feel that to be unjust in some sense, isn't it? Having a principle that we apply with a reasonable degree of rigour at least helps us to face up to these things. And that's where I think it's helpful to have principles about, say, violence or diet or, stuff like this. And then virtue ethics, obviously the strength of that is that it makes us think long term, as I said earlier. So we need to select the approach, particularly according to the objectivity we tend to lack. So particularly if we can become aware of a weakness in how well we judge a particular kind of situation, like the example I gave just now, we might be better off relying on a principle there. Perhaps supposing you decided to become a vegetarian, say, but you're not very good at sort of facing up to other people's disapproval of your dietary choices. You might be better off there, just sticking to your principle, rather than thinking, well, what will be the consequences if I offend this person by not eating their meat or whatever it is. Depending on where we can identify the weaknesses in ourselves, and I'm not suggesting this is a particularly appropriate thing to do for other people, but just thinking for ourselves about where the weaknesses lie. Similarly, it might be that we might lack attention to our own long-term objectivity for virtue ethics. So there's some people that are perhaps completely devoted to a social cause, say a pressure group or something like this, or maybe a religious group which is doing lots of social good, but they don't give any time to themselves, and as a result they tend to burn out, or their judgments become a bit ragged, and gradually they sort of wind down in their effectiveness because they're not giving enough time to the virtue ethics side of things. even though they're perhaps thinking quite rigorously in terms of the consequences of their actions or the principles they're abiding by. So that will be the kind of state in which, you know, we need to rebalance it a bit. Okay, so just a couple of examples of this in action. I mean, there are loads of examples in a new Buddhist ethics, which basically explores this in a whole raft of ethical issues in practice. But, you know, just to emphasise this, that this is just my way of trying to apply it to illustrate the principles at work, rather than, you know, trying to offer you a metaphysical principle in itself about these practical issues. So take the example of vegetarianism or veganism. So I think on the whole, and this is the reason why I'm a vegan or largely a vegan, is that I think a principled stand is very useful. It's useful to me to follow a principle. It provides clarity for me from day to day, so that I don't have to think or reassess the situation all the time. It provides relative clarity for other people, so they expect me to be vegan and to want to eat vegan food and so on. So it has a lot of social usefulness, but it's also psychologically useful and realistic to have a principle there. But on the other hand, I think it's quite useful to also remind oneself from time to time about the limitations of that principle and the cognitive model on which it's based. So that's why I like to deliberately make it impure, in a sense, by occasionally eating something forbidden. And I suppose it's also that when you've followed a principle like that for some time, it becomes an aesthetic issue as well. So this sort of yuck factor comes in, just like the yuck factor with cannibalism. You know, if we thought about those people in the Andes and, you know, yuck, you know, I wouldn't want to eat someone else. And that's an aesthetic response, isn't it, to that, imagining that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a similar yuck response, so, you know, give me a steak and I think yuck. And that's because I haven't eaten the steak for at least 20 years. And to be honest, I'd be hard put to it to eat a steak if you gave it me. But I can manage fish, for example, which is going some way towards making my principles impure. So there's sort of realistic ways, I think, of just slightly mitigating the inflexibility of principles. And another example here is euthanasia. And here I'm particularly thinking of voluntary euthanasia by somebody who's perhaps, you know, terminally ill and in great pain and wanting to die. Now, in general, I think there's a strong utilitarian case for such people who wish to die being able to die and being allowed by the law. In fact, I can't see any case for the law forbidding people from dying when they want to die. I suppose there may be some practical issues which have been pointed out, which no one could argue about, but regards how medicine interacts with that situation. But if you focus not so much on the legal issue, but about whether we will be justified in deciding to end our lives in such circumstances, it seems to me that depends. That sort of utilitarian judgment might need to be qualified a bit by thinking about other kinds of objectivity that we might need to face up to at the point of death or in the immediacy of death. So the question I'd want to ask myself is, would it be, would I gain in objectivity were I to face up to that pain or that full experience of dying, rather than, as it were, bottling out or leaving early because of a wish to avoid pain? Now, that may or may not be the case. I think one would have to make one's own choice. yeah. according to one's assessment of one's own state. And I would imagine probably for the vast majority of people are not in a position to benefit in any way from extreme pain. But I think there are also people who might, you know, benefit from going the whole way. And then there are people who do that on principle, and maybe, you know, something has been gained from that, even at the point of death. So there are different ways we could interpret objectivity in that situation. And it's not just a question, I think, of following consequentialism or following a principle. You know, we might need to use both of them as possible approaches.
Could you talk quickly about abortion? Or do you need to crack on?
If you're happy to extend the discussion.
Is it quite?
Yeah. Okay, well, abortion, again, I suppose there's the... obviously, there's a utilitarian case there that abortion can be very... Well, it can avoid pain. It can avoid pain both for the fetus and for the mother. And it can avoid difficulties for society in caring for someone with extreme disability, for example. So there are all sorts of reasons for abortion based on the consequences. There's also a principle which runs against it, which is about our respect for human life. And this all, I mean, the complexity with abortion, and perhaps the reason why I didn't include it on my actual plans for this because of the issue of personhood. And now I think that's where we need incrementalism, because the metaphysical approaches to abortion tend to either say the fetus is a person or the fetus is not a person. But experience seems to tell us when we actually look at how a fetus seems to be at different stages as they are gradually becoming a person. So rather than imposing this metaphysical model on the observations, we need to make our judgments on the basis of this gradation of experience.
And don't you think we do that to a large extent? I know the government at the moment are trying to bring that. Was it 20 weeks? I forget now. 20, 24?
I don't remember.
But, yeah, 24 is the legal limit.
Yeah, they're trying to bring it down to something like 12.
21, yeah. Yeah. Or 22. Yeah. But that's about the law primarily, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the morality of abortion as such. But
but there are moral issues in that because of the more conservative nature of the mindset of the people who are proposing this. Their ethical view, the law is being driven by their interpretation of what personhood means, which is a moral question, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it touches to some extent on what I was saying the other day about some metaphysical beliefs may be almost like hardwired into us, and I think personhood's a strong candidate for that. You know, it is very counterintuitive to see personhood as being something incremental. We just think of, you know, as soon as someone's got a bump, they have a person inside them, and as soon as... Yeah. And it's the same thing at the other end of life. It's like when you see a person sitting there in their, you know, nursing home chair, and they look to all intents and purposes like a human being, they are a human being.
Yeah.
But actually, they're so demented, there's just not a person identifiable there anymore. It's like, yeah.
So it's the same as with the cognitive biases we were talking about. I don't feel that. When I see a bump, I don't think there's a person there. And right. When someone is that deeply affected by dementia, I also feel that person's already gone.
Mm. I think you can notice incrementality in this, though, in experience. So, for example, if a woman has a miscarriage, she's going to feel a certain degree of emotional disease with what's happened. And just generalising, if the baby dies stillborn, that's going to be worse than a miscarriage. But again, this person would often start, we don't normally give a name to the child until they actually enter the world.
Yeah.
But I think there's a difference between having an abortion at 2 months and then having an abortion at 8 months because you want to go on a skiing holiday.
Because one's, it's this thing about addressing different conditions and using different principles or different approaches in different situations. Yeah. I find the notion that an infant, even after we've given it a name and after it's been born, has possibly got less personhood than an adult orangutan, you know?
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the thought of, you know, killing orangutan, and that's like, yeah, it's a, most people would not see that's a bad thing to do, but you probably get off with a few months in prison, whereas you killed a baby. Well,
Peter Singer talks a lot about this, doesn't he?
Does he? Yeah.
Interesting guy to...
I've got a lot of respect for Peter Singer, actually, in the sense that he brings some of these points to people's attention in a way which kind of forces them to think more objectively about the situation, even though his model is utilitarian, but he uses utilitarianism in quite a skillful way, I think. So you can say similar things about the most sophisticated moral thinkers in different schools.